Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends to doctors in women's health.
How are things going there for you guys? How are the COVID cases?
Well, we're sort of anticipating our next big surge to hit in the coming week to 2 weeks to see things really pick up. So
Okay. We're
sort of getting ready. It's always an ebb and flow. We see more new admissions towards the end of the week than the beginning of the week, that sort of thing. So.
And can you talk about how your pregnancy patients are faring?
Well, you know, in our experience, about 95% of women have had mild infection or asymptomatic infection, because we're tracking pretty carefully all of the women who are diagnosed in our system, including outpatients, including those women who have easy access to outside testing, which is more and more common these days. And so rather than come to your clinic or call your clinic and ask them to order our tests, which are through a drive-through center, women will frequently go to a rapid testing site and get a rapid test and then report that result to us.
Okay.
And so, but they're still our patients. So we're still having to track those women and make sure they're doing okay and follow-up calls and all those things. So it's quite an operation.
Yeah.
So then in the 5% that get really sick, that's been who we have learned a lot about COVID from. So, you know, all of the implications to a pregnancy, certainly, and how that affects pregnancy outcomes in those critically ill women. And then we've learned a lot about how far, how far you can go in terms of respiratory support in our system. It may be different from hospital to hospital in terms of what the resources are, but certainly what level of respiratory support is reasonable to provide before you start thinking about an early delivery in those women who are later in pregnancy, that sort of thing. That all those questions are very real for us right now.
Talk to me about the vaccine. From your standpoint right now, what is the most meaningful fact that you want practicing OBGYNs and their patients to know about the vaccine?
I think keeping everything in the right perspective is really important. When we talk about risks and benefits, right now we're comparing the benefits and risks of this vaccine to the benefits and risks of getting COVID, because the likelihood is that if we, despite being vaccinated, even with vaccination, we will all be exposed to COVID. The transmission level is too high right now, and it is too unpredictable. And so the choices are vaccination or be exposed to COVID and take your chances with the actual disease. And we know that 5% getting severe to critical illness is not a small number when you multiply that across millions. That's why our hospitals are filling up. And so it is a very real risk. The infection and the disease are very real to us. The risks in a pregnant woman who is in that unlucky 5% are very real. And the vaccine, the benefits and risks of the vaccine have to be considered in that context, in the context of this pandemic and the biggest public health crisis that we've seen for generations. And so the potential benefit is protection from COVID, 95% protection for both the available vaccines. Mm-hmm. And the risks of the vaccine have to do mostly with these short-term side effects that we know about. We haven't had this vaccine long enough to know long-term risks, but is there any vaccine that we can think of for which we have to counsel a woman on long-term health risks of a vaccine? Is there anything you can think of? I can't think of one. There's no vaccine that I can think of in existence that requires pre-administration counseling of. We think this vaccine may cause you to become infertile. No. We think this vaccine may have some long-term health effects, but we suggest you get it anyway. So that doesn't exist. It's not a thing. And so while we don't exactly have all the information that we need to know yet for long-term benefits, it's clear that one long-term benefit is you don't get COVID and you don't have the long-term health risks of having had COVID. And certainly there is lack of evidence for any potential risk. It's all theoretical at this point. The risks are all theoretical. It's some of them are frankly just made up, but the benefit is very real.
And what are some of the ones that you've seen? This is where the mainstream media.
Yes, has certainly done its job in disseminating some very inaccurate information, I would say.
Yes.
Some of the risks and questions that I have heard most frequently are, what are the implications for fertility? What are the risks to fertility? And really, that's a question that that has not been tested in terms of scientific evidence. There has not been an actual study to say that this vaccine puts a woman's fertility at risk, because in order to study things, it needs to be a valid question, right? Is there a reason that we would think that the vaccine is a risk for fertility or for women who desire to become pregnant? That's not based in science. And so that is a theoretical fear, but it's not a risk that's based in science or fact. And so that's one of the most common things. There is no recommendation to delay pregnancy if you get the vaccine. I've heard that as well. And I've even heard that it has been put on a handout in doctor's offices that they should delay pregnancy for X number of months after they get the vaccine. That ACOG explicitly addresses that and says there is no basis for recommending delay in attempting pregnancy. What else? What are the recommendations for, like, trimester? Am I supposed to wait until the third trimester to get vaccinated if I'm pregnant? That's a common question.
Okay.
And there is no recommendation for a specific trimester because they unfortunately excluded pregnant women from vaccine trials. And so we don't exactly have information about the immune response robustness in a pregnant woman in the first trimester versus the third trimester. And so in this setting of very extremely high community transmission, the recommendation in general is to get vaccinated as soon as it is available to you. Because the earlier you can protect yourself with that first shot, and then you should get the second shot and not skip the second dose, the more you're protected from the actual infection.
And it's not the same as the swine flu, but I have I had my daughter in the fall of 2009 when the swine flu was raging. And so here's my next question: breastfeeding mothers. And that's what I had done. I had had my daughter, and then the vaccine became available, and I went and got it at the first available opportunity, and knew then, or surmised, that some of the antibodies might then be available to the baby via the breast milk. What do you say? What about breastfeeding mothers with this?
Yes, the Academy for Breastfeeding Medicine actually says that although we don't have all of the studies done to say to what degree antibodies from mom who have been vaccinated pass through breast milk to the babies, there's certainly the potential there for multiple types of antibodies to pass through to the baby. And we can't vaccinate neonates, right? So in pregnancy, we intentionally vaccinate pregnant women, particularly for influenza and Tdap, to protect the babies, right? This is partly to protect mom, but also to protect babies, because we know that maternal antibodies can pass through either transplacental migration or through breast milk and protect the neonates. And neonates just don't have the immune system to be able to vaccinate them. And so while we don't have all of that evidence for SARS-CoV-2 virus yet, There are some studies that demonstrate antibodies in breast milk, and certainly the potential is there. And so I would say for as a pregnant woman in any trimester, as with a breastfeeding or lactating person, to get the vaccine as soon as it becomes available to you.
And any fears of, you know, it's like the information you had presented, was it for individuals who had experienced potential Bell's palsy?
Yes. So there was, as part of these trials, they have to track all of the side effects that are reported by patients in either arm of the trial. They're huge trials. So 40,000 people, that's a lot of people. You have to track everything, and they have to report it as part of their study. It's an obligation by the company as part of their clinical trial to report any side effect. And whether or not that side effect is related to the vaccine, that's completely independent of what they're tracking, right? They don't make that decision. All they do is say, do you have any symptoms today? What are the symptoms? And record it. And then later on, after they can review the data and unblind it, they and in the interim analyses, they determine whether or not those side effects may be related to the vaccine. And so as part of that tracking, they recorded some patients in both arms of the Moderna study that had symptoms of Bell's palsy. And the analysis of that data was that it was not due to the vaccine because they were in both arms. And so while that the words Bell's palsy then became associated with that vaccine, right? The fear is there that people don't really understand what the linkage is. It's simply because that's part of the clinical trial, you know, data safety mechanism of tracking those side effects, but it's not because the vaccine causes it. And certainly as we learn more about these vaccines, we learn more and more about the milder side effects, but there's no evidence that the vaccine is causing these things.
Including any potential ill effects, and I asked Kathy about this too, for those individuals who may have Botox or other cosmetic fillers.
Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting one. Okay. So I had read there were a couple of reports of some swelling around those injection sites in patients that had had fillers before and then got vaccinated. And again, the data is not really clear that that is from the vaccine. However, you know, those are important to know about, but there's no evidence to suggest that that is a vaccine specific thing. And the degree of severity is certainly important to take into consideration. Any kind of aches and pains that we feel, that can be part of life, right? But if it is related to the vaccine, it is important to recognize and understand in the context of this global pandemic, right? Our aches and pains, our mild febrile reactions, worth it to each of us as an individual and part of a greater society who are fighting this pandemic, is it worth it to us yes. to endure these aches and pains, to all be protected and protect each other and those who are most vulnerable and may not mount the same kind of immune response to the vaccine and may get sickest. And so, you know, it's I think it's a matter of perspective.
Absolutely. And what of the type of vaccine that these are compared to not, you know, not using the live virus, right? These are mRNA.
Right. And I think another question that I get commonly is this is a new thing. So how can we trust it, right? Trust is really a big issue right now. And we have to come at this very humble because certainly the history of trust in medicine is not, we come from a history of causing great suffering to underserved and minority communities. And that's on us, right? We have to come to this moment with the perspective that we didn't build trust in the past, right? And so now we're attempting to catch up with a lot of that and to overcome that mistrust and suffering that has been caused in the past. So what about this mRNA vaccine, right? So importantly, the technology that has been used to sequence the virus and then develop the mRNA vaccines is DNA sequencing technology. And that technology has actually been developed decades ago and has become the basis for a lot of our current technologies in development of antimicrobials, cancer drugs. And there are actually mRNA-based cancer trials out there that are active in recruiting that are using this same type of technology uh-huh. in patients to deliver cancer therapies. And so it is not that this is the first time we've ever tried this. It's that the technology that we that scientists were able to use very efficiently has been in the works for decades. It's just that this is the first time it has been used for this virus in this context of a global pandemic and on this scale. And we are very fortunate that it could be coordinated so quickly.
Is there anything else that you would like to add that you're hearing or that you would like to address that from what you're hearing there at your, yeah. at your medical center?
I think some of the major questions that I hear are certainly about what, well, I don't really know about the long-term effects of the vaccine. So why, you know, are there concerns about that? And the answer I have is, well, the long-term effects of the vaccine is true are not really known because we've only had the vaccines around for a few months now. But we do know something about the long-term effects of COVID for patients who got COVID early on in this pandemic and were intubated and paralyzed on a ventilator for months and months and are just now leaving the hospital. That's long enough to know that this is a life-changing virus for some. And so we don't even know about long-term effects of the virus on their health, much less the virus on a woman of reproductive age. The questions about whether the vaccine causes infertility, well, I don't actually know what the virus does to fertility, right? So there are a lot of different questions that we don't know at this point in time. Seems like the best way to prevent having to answer some of those more difficult questions are to prevent infection to begin with. And yeah. so I think having some perspective and context in the setting of we're all on the same team here. Yeah. We're not just trying to prevent our own illness, but we are trying to help protect those around us. That's a really important perspective to have.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Pap Talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.